Hello and welcome to What the Hack, the show that is dedicated to taking all aspects of cybersecurity and breaking them down into easy to understand bites. My name is Sean, a cybersecurity professional working in the Aberdeen, Scotland area. This week we have Martin Smith, CBMBE, and Keith Chappelle from Cyber Prism. Martin is the managing director of the company, and during a 33-year military career, he worked extensively in the maritime security and maintained a strong focus on information superiority. He led Britain's maritime counterterrorism force, modernized the Royal Marines information and intelligence capability, commanded multinational counter-piracy operations, and was responsible for Britain's amphibious force. He spent three periods in Afghanistan, both in command of forces on the ground and government-level advisory roles. He commanded service personnel at every rank and left the armed forces in January of 2018, having led the nation's 7,000 Royal Marines as their commandant general. Keith is the technical director of the company, and he has worked in senior hands-on cybersecurity roles for 20 years, including cyber protection and safety critical system of a wide range of vessels and of critical national infrastructure at home and abroad. He has been employed in government security agencies and more recently was technical business director of L3 Group. His work has included cybersecurity surveys on military and civilian vessels from offshore patrol vessels to container ships, cruise liners and super yachts, and the subsequent remedial design and implementation of cyber attack protection. Keith contributed to the network security architecture of Britain's Type 26 frigate and has developed and implemented technologies that allow operational technology equipment on vessels to be protected and monitored. Keith is a fellow of the British Computer Society and is the only information auditor within the GCHQ Certified Cyber Professions Scheme declared at lead professional level, the highest level achievable. He has recently been asked to act as the competency and experience assessor for others seeking the same qualification. We hope you enjoy. Right, so thanks guys for joining us this week. Today we're going to be talking all about operational technology, and I believe you two are the experts in the field. So we've got a bunch of questions lined up, and we're going to try and get through them all. Operational technology, I don't know who would like to kick us off really, but explaining what that is exactly. I'm sure most people will know about it once they've heard the explanation.
Well, I think this is one for the technical director. Keith, do you want to kick us off on this?
Okay, well, the definition of operational technology that we like to use is any technology or system that is actually required to operate your business safely. We consider a number of risks when we talk about safety. So, you know, we consider obviously human safety, but also commercial safety and environmental safety. You know, systems that you really need to operate your business. Now, that may include, you know, conventional IT systems, email, web access, web applications. Certainly, you know, banks, you know, they're completely reliant on web apps for the users to be able to use the application. So arguably, you could say that those are operational technologies because they're operationally germane to the operation of a bank. But more typically, people assume that operational technology just relates to industrial control systems, IoT devices, so you know, cameras, things that people might have around their home, but also systems that we use to control power generation, water production, water distribution, energy distribution. And obviously there's a classification of operational technology which goes one step above, which would be critical national infrastructure. So anything that's required to support the operation of a nation drops into critical national infrastructure. And almost exclusively, all of that stuff is operational technology.
Yeah, you often find people sort of thinking that they don't have operational technology. If their business is intensely office-based, they'll say, well, you know, we just have IT. We have an enterprise IT system, and that's how we run our business. And the question for them is, oh, you have an office. So you're in a building. That building have an alarm system, have CCTV. How about the sewage system? If I interfere with that, I suspect I'm affecting your business. So most businesses are involved with OT in one way, shape or form, even if it's not the core function of their business.
Right. Okay. I'm sort of getting the vibe that it's far more fundamental than people are making out or maybe assuming incorrectly. So an example that Keith, you brought up there was the IoT.
The reason I bring that up is because I've developed my house to be a smart home, and there's very little that isn't actually connected to it. I've got the blinds and the heating and the lights and the TVs and everything that's connected to it. These are all aspects of operational technology in a sense, yeah?
They certainly enable you to operate your home in a more convenient and hopefully energy efficient way.
I think so.
But a question maybe to ask yourself is, do you know what communication is going on with those devices? You know, are they calling out from outside your premises to somewhere else? And would you know if that was the case? You know, for example, I similar to yourself, I avail myself of all this technology to make my life easier at home. You know, I've got the Alexa, I've got the Hive heating controls, et cetera, et cetera. I've got security cameras. But I know for sure that none of those devices are communicating outside of my home because I've specifically configured rules on my firewall to prevent data egress, because I buy the cheapest and most cheerful security cameras, and I genuinely don't trust them. You know, they come from China. It doesn't really matter where they come from. I don't know what's going on inside them. But if they can't communicate outside my perimeter, I don't care. I'll buy the cheapest.
That's quite interesting, actually. You've got me thinking now, because I actually don't know if it's doing that. So I'm going to have to go and check. So as soon as we sign off here, that's the first thing I'm going to go and try and do and figure out that. Pretty interesting, actually. But of course, operational technology is a lot more vast than just the kind of smart home devices, really. I mean, you talked about the sewage systems and everything, energy plants and things like that. They all have operational technology within it. Now, the question that comes to mind is, was that always a thing? I suppose when technology was built, when certain aspects of it was built, they implemented it. And was it always considered operational technology, or is this a term that's been coined simply because we try to categorize the technology? Does that make sense?
It does. I think there is a degree of a change in vocabulary. But operational technology pre-existed long before IT. So, you know, in the dark days of power generation and water treatment, we still had automated control systems. But they were pneumatic-based, so we're using 3 to 15 PSI of air to control devices rather than digital signals that we now use. So they were inherently unusual. But the technologies between IT and OT, the platforms that are used, the cabling, the PCs, are so similar now that people have a need to be able to differentiate between what is IT and what is OT, because actually the infrastructure looks very similar, the networking components, etc.
Yeah, and it's true to say that many of the systems we're working on contain components that might be 40 years old. And that's one of the issues that we have, because some of these components now can no longer be updated or patched effectively, or at least cost effectively. So we're now, you know, introducing systems that will pair with legacy systems that allow them to remain protected. The other thing that we've seen happen over the last 10 years or so is OT-IT convergence. Okay. So whereas classically OT would have been thought of as relatively safe because you would have maintained a complete air gap between your IT and your OT network, nowadays, in order to take advantage of smart control systems and other factors, we're increasingly seeing the two networks linked, and we need to find ways to do that safely.
Wow. So 40 years old for some technology that's still operational now. You're saying that you have to find ways of protecting these, but they're no longer supported, and you've got to kind of merge them with today's technology. Does having that, I suppose is the question, does having that kind of technology in your business prevent a greater risk to you?
It doesn't present a greater risk as long as you manage the risk. So, you know, if you take healthcare, for example, obviously not 40-year-old technology, but, you know, MRI scanners, CAT scanners are very high-value capital assets. Mm-hmm. They may still be running Windows XP or even Windows NT, and that's fine as long as there's a wrapper put around that device to make sure that it's protected from external threats. So you compare, you know, a legacy device with a current technology firewall or router immediately in front of that device to make a new MRI system, if you like, that is secure, is defended, and is updating itself. So that, you know, a firewall is constantly updating and is self-defending itself against emergent and new attacks.
That's excellent. So let's lean into the idea of the MRI scanner, because like you said, it's a very high value one, and I think it's something that everyone can kind of grasp very quickly. So basically what we're saying is it's sort of isolated itself because of the technology that's in it, because it being so old and things like that. It's got to be not offline as such, but it's got to be protected away from everything else. It's not on the main circuit, if you like.
Well, typically they are currently on the main network. They're connected alongside everything else. But because they are particularly vulnerable, best practice is to deploy local protection on a per device or per group of devices basis. So instead of having, as you probably have at your home, a firewall out at the edge, probably provided by your internet service provider, that protects incoming communications doing any harm in your network, what we have to accept in a healthcare network that is vast, but there is probably already malware operating within inside that network. So if you accept that the malware is already there, you actually need to protect the vulnerable device specifically and individually against what may already exist in the network. So it's a layered approach. You have firewalls at your boundary, but actually where you have a vulnerable device, you put a protective wrapper around it. You wrap a firewall around it to protect just that device, or maybe just the radiology department. So you protect, you know, 6 or 7 of these similarly vulnerable devices with a single protective device. And as long as that protective device is getting updates and is constantly maintained, then you've really raised the level of protection for those vulnerable devices to an equivalent level as perhaps a Windows 10 device that's still sat on the same network but has been patched up to date.
Right, okay. I think that pretty much answers the question for me. So they're safe enough to use as the end user would expect it to be, I guess. The question becomes operational technology. Is this something that all businesses should be concerned about? All different sizes, all different sectors, everything. Is it something that they all need to consider looking into? Because from what I can gather, operational technology as a term is something that of the businesses that I've spoke to in preparation for this episode, they had very little knowledge about.
I think that's true. People don't realize how much operational technology they are dependent upon. So we have businesses that use local data centers, but also, you know, AWS and Azure data centers. But those local data centers are absolutely dependent on cooling water, for example, and air conditioning to maintain the data center in a condition where the servers will exist happily and be reliable. But people forget that actually, you know, if I'm pretending to be an attacker, I'll look for the easiest means to disrupt your business. And the easiest means to disrupt your business might not be delivering malware into your estate. It might be disrupting your data center. So interrupting the power, interrupting the cooling water, interfering with the air conditioning, maybe making it just too hot in the data center so the servers fall over naturally because they're too hot. And similarly, you know, within people's office premises, they typically have, you know, an IT cupboard where everything's stashed away. You know, how physically secure is that IT cupboard? It doesn't matter whether you're a small business user or an industrial premises. You know, you need to consider physical security. It's all about managing the whole of the risk surface that you're presenting.
An example might be an attack on, it's a Danish hotel, whereby the malware locked all of the rooms. You know, very, very simple attack, you know, against an operational system that probably wouldn't have been considered as a cyber risk.
Wow.
Taking that to its next level, you know, effectively, if you then set the fire alarm off, you're a terrorist. You've locked people into the room. You've threaten them with fire, whether or not it exists. So most people are terrorized. It's really important that people think like an attacker, not think like a defender, because thinking like a defender, you'll go out and buy the new shiny product from company X, Y, or Z that's sold as being a panacea, and you'll simply overlook all the really basic things that you should be doing, you know, locking the doors, applying the simplest of firewalls. 80% of the firewalls we have a look at have inbound firewalls to stop malware coming in, but they have no outbound firewalls to stop someone stealing your data once they're inside. And, you know, you've already bought this hardware. You just need to set it up appropriately.
It can be quite a scary topic then. I love talking about the cybersecurity functions because it really shows just how terrifying and worrying that you can put into someone. If you've got a bit of knowledge that you want to portray on someone, especially from a company like yourselves talking about this kind of stuff, it really shows just how scared you can make a person with a 5-minute conversation, because all of that is very achievable. I suppose...
I think that's also part of the problem, Sean, that people are a little bit scared and intimidated because they have a lack of understanding.
Yeah.
And very often that drives a head in the sand response, not a let's actually have a look at these risks, let's put them in a priority order that's relevant to our business, and then let's address those in priority order to reduce our risk exposure. It's a risk management proposition. You know, it's like maintaining the lifeboats on your ship. It's no different. You just need to manage the risks and not be scared of them.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I've often compared cybersecurity to what was the Health and Safety Act back in 1974. When that came into effect, a lot of people were up in arms about it. They didn't like how, and now it's just second nature. You know, people that's affected now. So I'm expecting this whole industry to be second nature 10, 15 years from now. But we're in the midst of trying to get to grips with it. Companies still don't have budgets for this kind of stuff. And quite often, they don't have anyone responsible for it. So if operational technology is just as big a threat, who would you kind of point the finger at being responsible for that in a company?
Really?
Well,
good.
I think that's a huge issue. And your health and safety analogy does get used quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's significant now that actually the enforcement arm for cyber responsibility for industrial control systems is actually the health and safety executive.
All right.
there's a general understanding that cyber has a direct bearing on safety.
In terms of the governance question you asked, it's very central to what we do and what we've seen out in industry. And in a sense, every company seems to treat this in a slightly different way. What we do know is that if you're going to manage threats to operational technology and IT, you need a multifunctional team. And that multifunctional approach needs to extend from the board level right down to the worker level. So it introduces management complexity that I think a lot of companies are still struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, it's sort of the company's only as strong as the weakest link, really. So it's got to incorporate everyone, of course. But I look back a couple of years ago when we introduced GDPR into the world, and all companies, because it was being enforced by law, all companies fell over themselves to try and get to grips with it very, very quickly. And the panic level shot up to a certain level and then dropped straight back down about 5 months later because they realized they weren't coming after them. And that's not to say that they aren't, but they just haven't yet. So it was almost like a panic for nothing. And I guess cybersecurity is the same thing. It's just they won't do anything about it until they become a victim of it. So it's kind of trying to be proactive about it.
It's an insurance sell. You know, you don't need insurance till the worst happens. You don't need to consider cyber insurance till the worst happens. It's not strictly the case.
No.
Cybersecurity, you know, in the same way as a fire in your premises can wipe out your business. But it is about managing those risks. And you were talking about having people responsible for managing risks. You don't necessarily need somebody with all the skills in all the areas. But what's really important to identify is what you don't know, and seek help in those areas. So, you know, rather than outsource cybersecurity whole scale to company A, well, you're probably quite capable of doing 80% of that in-house, because you know your business, you know what's essential to you. Company A doesn't, but you might know very little about a particular system or a particular method that you're dependent on. Get help for that little bit. You know, use your cybersecurity budget wisely, and only spend it on risks that are on your risk register. Mm-hmm. And that risk on your risk register might be, we simply don't know enough about this to manage it. So we'll spend money to get help. We'll identify and narrow down the risks, and we'll put that risk back into our risk register and manage it along with everything else.
So a company, company should be treating this like, in a sense, like any other risk. And health and safety would be a very good example. And sometimes we deal with clients who are asking whether they need to set up a bespoke cybersecurity risk management system. They're probably already running at least one, maybe several, very effective risk management systems within their company. And health and safety is a really good example of that. So treat it like any other risk, manage it effectively, and as Keith says, be smart about when you outsource and what you outsource for.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, actually. So for the kind of governance side of things, we're talking about the sort of treat it as a risk. That's absolutely true. But I suspect legislation hasn't caught up with it yet. And I'm sort of worried in the idea that it never will, in the essence that cybersecurity has always been reactive as such, because there's always new threats, there's always new things popping up. So is it possible for legislation to catch up, if that makes sense?
I think, you know, more inspired legislation can. And by that, I mean, rather than legislating a set of minimum criteria you must achieve, as they did in the United States for power generation, for example, which failed horrendously, rather than set a minimum set of specifications, which tends to drive a race to the bottom, it tends to drive a race to compliance, not a race to best practice.
Sure.
Rather than taking that approach, legislating around a maturity-based approach with maturity assessments. So, for example, in the maritime industry, the International Maritime Organization has just released their new regulations. And rather than say you must do this and you must do that, they're advocating that you have a risk management approach, you review it regularly, and you continually improve. And the UK government has a system called the IAM, you know, the Information Assurance Maturity Model, which is very similar in that, you know, if you decide you want to achieve level three and you achieve level three this year, you won't achieve level three next year unless you can demonstrate that you've improved. You might not move up to level four, but in order to retain the same level in the structure, you need to demonstrate that you're constantly reviewing, constantly improving.
Got you. Okay, that makes sense to me. So we've covered a lot of the business aspects of it. A question that I've got is, I know we spoke about kind of IT being in business and then the Internet of Things as well. Is this something that personal individuals need to be concerned about as a whole? And if so, is it as complicated to deal with?
I think, especially at the moment with COVID, it's absolutely vital that people take some personal responsibility for their own cyber and their company's cyber security while they're working at home. It's unreasonable to expect a large enterprise. It's unreasonable to expect a large enterprise to be able to control what goes on in all their employees' homes.
Sure.
So, you know, for example, I'm at home working, talking to you. My wife's upstairs working. She works for health service, and my daughter's studying in another room. We're all consuming bandwidth, but we're all effectively opening channels to the outside world that each other could be affected by. So obviously, you know, I'm quite fortunate. I'm quite cybersecurity aware. I've got a really robust firewall with inbound and outbound firewall rules. But I suspect, Sean, for example, you're not in that position. You probably do have a firewall. It's been provided by your internet service provider. I would suggest it's unlikely you've ever visited that firewall and tuned its performance and made selections in there to only allow the services that you use. And I, you know, most households in the UK, well, most households anyway, will be in a similar position. Mm-hmm. You know, by having people working at home, they're introducing significant vulnerabilities to the businesses that they're connecting back to.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, actually. And it's surprising that we haven't had, I guess, more incidents of hackings and things like that since the kind of work from home has become more of a popular thing. So operational technology working from home is a big thing at the minute. But I guess most people working from home stick, like you just said, they stick to the very basics of what they do. You know, they've got their computer and they do their job without thinking about the greater aspects of what we're talking about here. So I guess, is there sort of advice that you can give, very practical advice, on how to make it more protected or what to look out for, without delving into the kind of firewall aspect of it, where some people may get a little bit lost?
Yeah, I mean, sure. But I mean, we're really straying into IT rather than OT when we're talking about sort of working from home type systems, unless you are controlling process plant from home, in which case, obviously, that's operational technology. But G6Q or NCSC now published a fantastic piece of guidance. It's just called the NCSC 10 Steps. Okay. So if people wanted to Google the NCSC 10 Steps, it's a fantastic, really basic 10 easy things you can do to significantly reduce your risk profile.
Excellent. Well, certainly we'll put a little link to that in the show notes for it. One question that we had in kind of preparation for this was, companies were under the impression, I spoke to four different companies about it, operational technology as a whole, and without fail, they all had the same response. My company doesn't have to worry about that. It's too small. Have we got any response to that?
Yeah. I mean, my first one, I get that from, I've had that from sort of fairly significant companies in the oil and gas sector. But I think the point is that, just remember, you don't have to be the target. You can be collateral damage in someone else's attack. And one of the most infamous attacks was against Maersk, a malware called NotPetya, which happened in 2017. And it wasn't an attack against Maersk. I think that's the whole point. Maersk were caught up in an attack against a much smaller company. And of course, it wasn't just Maersk. Lots of other companies suffered from the same malware in the same sort of time frame. So that's the point, really. If you don't think you're going to be targeted, you might be right, but you could very easily be collateral damage in someone else's attack.
Right, so it's sort of...
And that someone else could be your accountant. It could be the electronic package you use to manage your receipts and invoices. It could be Microsoft OneDrive. It could be Google Drive. It could be any of these external organizations that your company depends on. Obviously the larger ones, you know, the Microsofts and the Amazon Web Services of this world have really, you know, really comprehensive cybersecurity protection and will probably tell you you're a victim of an attack long before you know. But lots of people will be exchanging information, especially at this time of year, for year end, with their accountants. And if I want to find out all sorts of information about, you know, your business, then maybe going after your accountant would be quite a sensible thing for me to do. And, you know, the accountancy company itself will have dependency on other businesses. It's unlikely they run an accounts package that they've developed themselves. They'll have bought it in from somewhere else. And you really need to look at that whole supply chain. You know, who has access to my data? Who are they giving access to my data to? What happens to that data when they've stopped using it? You know, what will your accountants do with your data once they've processed your books? You know, do they destroy it? No, we'll probably stick it away on a hard drive somewhere and it persists forever.
Wow, it's quite...
But in the same way, you know, that might be business critical data, it might be operational technology data, or it could just be IT data. Really, the way we look after the data doesn't matter too much.
Sure.
All we need to remember is that for IT, confidentiality is the most important thing. You know, I don't want my bank details leaking via an email. You know, confidentiality is key. But for the system that operates the brakes on my car or generates power and delivers it to my house, availability is absolutely key. So in the IT world, if something goes wrong, generally we can just turn it off until we fix it. in the OT world, absolutely the wrong thing to do is, if it's infected with malware, turn it off, because something bad is going to happen. So we have got this completely different set of priorities for IT versus OT. So IT, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And for operational technology, availability, integrity, and confidentiality is very much bottom of the pecking order.
That's quite interesting, actually. It's a scary world, actually, when you're talking about it. Let's move on real quick about the main differences we're talking about between IT and OT. From what I can gather, and this is a very basic overview from what I can see, is operational technology is very tangible. It's working things that you would see in factories, for example, whereas IT is very much behind the computer. Is that correct, or have I completely misread that?
I don't think you've completely misread it, but that's kind of one take on it.
Yeah.
I think sort of a more robust definition maybe does come back down to that confidentiality versus availability.
Sure.
Dichotomy. So if the system is more important to you to be available, then it's operational technology. If it's more important to be confidential, then it's information technology. So in a power station, you know, the operator sat at his console. He may have a PC receiving his emails, and he may have another terminal operating the process plant. One of those absolutely must work. If he can't get his email, then that might actually be a blessing. but, you know, they are very, very different systems, but are very often presented right next to each other and will look exactly the same. You know, these are both PCs. They're both displaying information graphically to the operator, but have very different consequences if they're infected with malware or subverted by an attack.
Understand. Yeah, okay, fair. That's pretty easy to understand, actually, when you break it down the way that you've done there. Excellent. I think we've pretty much covered everything about what we were aiming to cover. I'm sure when people listen to this, they're probably going to have questions about it. I know that you guys are far better placed to answer them than me. So how would we best get in touch with you to ask the questions?
Yeah, get in touch by email. And we'll leave you contact details all through our website. And we're really happy to field questions from people, especially in this particular area of operational technology, which isn't always very well understood.
No, that would be perfect. I mean, it's a far bigger industry than I would say most people know about it. They probably suspect that it's for niche companies or certain sized companies, and as operational as the word is, it's got to be some vast machinery and vast, you know, huge amount of technology involved in it. But from what I can gather, that's certainly not the case. It can come down to the smallest of items and the smallest of companies. And like you said, it's not even have to be their target. So
everyone should have this on their radar, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. It may be central to your business. Mm-hmm. It may be important. It may be a bit peripheral. But everyone should have it on their radar.
Yeah. We could be talking about, you know, heating and air conditioning in your home. We could be talking about charging your EV that sat on the drive. You know, that arguably, you know, if you're an electric vehicle driver, then that's operational technology, because obviously it's heavily dependent on technology to operate safely. But having access to it, the utility of being able to get in that car and drive, that's an availability issue. So you might be, you know, caring for somebody else. You might need to go to hospital. You probably need to go get food at some point in your life. You know, the availability of that piece of operational kit is really important. And, you know, as an attacker, again, thinking like an attacker, why would I want to attack the car? That's probably being, you know, quite carefully protected by the likes of Tesla and his friends. But the charger that sat on your wall outside your garage that charges that vehicle is probably a very easy target. If you can't charge the car, you've lost the utility of it. And it really comes back to, I say, think like an attacker. Try not to think like a defender. How would I ruin your business?
Wow, what a grim outlook. But it's certainly effective. I do go back to a story I read about the massive chain Target in America, where they suffered an attack from I think it was about $300 million they lost. And it was because of the payment systems that they use in their stores. So they obviously attacked the smaller ones. So yeah, completely effective. And yeah, like I say, it's very grim to be able to think like that, but unbelievably effective. So it's, I think we all need to do that from now on. Okay, what we'll do is we'll put a link of into your website into the show notes for people to kind of browse and maybe get in contact with you. I want to thank you for your time because it's been a bit of an eye opener. It certainly gave me an opportunity to go and reassess my home in terms of what is connected and what's going out. So thank you for that. And I'm sure the people listening are going to be very grateful for the insight that you've just given. So one thing that we do want to do at the end of each episode is provide some practical piece of advice that they can go and do on this topic. So is there anything that you could potentially give on operational technology that someone, business or individual, can go and have a look at to maybe fix, if not improve?
Okay. I think just narrowing it down to one is difficult. I think my advice would be make a start. Don't put it off. Just make a start. It's not too difficult. It's just managing risk. You probably do that already. A second one would be don't spend any money unless it's to address a risk. So don't be suckered by salesmen. There are sharks in the water. And you know, from a personal point of view, individual point of view, I think the primary attack vector at the moment, and it will be for a while, is phishing and spear phishing. So be really cautious about emails that you don't know who they're from, that have links in them. We still genuinely use links in emails for everyday business. Yeah, we've established this communication via a Teams call. We emailed you a link, you clicked on the link, or actually you emailed us for link and we clicked on the link. You know, it would be really easy for an attacker to spoof an email that looks just like a Teams invite. And it's, you know, it's really, really easy to get people on a phishing hook. When we do phishing tests, we have about a 60% success rate. So, wow, you know, that, company of 100 people, 60 people click on the link.
That's much higher than I expected it to be. Oh, dear.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to the amount of effort the attacker puts in. If you go out and buy on the dark web a phishing attack, you might get, you know, 12 to 20%. But if you take the time to find out what correspondence normally looks like, how the email might normally be signed, what format, what font, what logos it should have, you can really very quickly get that percentage success rate up. So it doesn't matter if it's IT or OT, we see phishing as one of the main infection ingestion mechanisms at the moment.
Excellent. We'll keep an eye out for that. 60% is much higher than it should be. If we can get that down to under 10, then it would be perfect, but unbelievable. So,
well, Sean, I think you talked about this before, because you compared cybersecurity to health and safety, and you effectively said that we've built a health and safety culture. And if I walk around Aberdeen talking to oil and gas companies, it is really obvious there is a palpable health and safety culture. You can almost touch it and smell it. And that is not the same for cybersecurity, because it's much newer. And what looks big and scary now needs to be sort of ingested into a culture of cybersecurity, at which point levels of understanding should improve quite considerably. Okay. But it's behavioral, not just a question of training.
Oh, that's an interesting approach, actually. I think most people are avoiding that kind of idea, mainly because it probably takes a lot longer to kind of do it that way. But it's certainly reactive at the moment, so we're sort of waiting for it to become cultural rather than just what it is at the moment, which is somewhat unsuccessful, because it still happens. More and more people are still suffering attacks, and I was always told that there are two types of people in the world: those that have been hacked and those that don't know they've been hacked. So it's trying to avoid that kind of thing. So it's been very interesting, certainly from an operational technology point of view. It's certainly opened eyes to a whole different sector that people may have been unaware of. So I want to thank you for your time again. And yeah, I'll put some links into the show notes for the website. And yeah, hopefully we can do it again in the future. It's been very interesting for me. So thanks again.
Pleasure.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. That is all we have for this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a like and subscribe to hear more from experts around the globe. And head over to opensourceguardian.com for more great content, all targeting the world of cybersecurity. Until next time, remember, it shouldn't be complicated, so we don't make it so.